Well, these really are the high holy days of secular culture in America. We've got, well, I think it's fair to say that Mardi Gras is, though religious in origin, that religion is probably paganism. We have Groundhog's Day, a great holiday and holy day that I'll be explaining a little bit. We also have the greatest secular holy day of the year, which is Super Bowl Sunday, and I'll explain why that is a religious holiday. How do we separate the religious from the non-religious, the sacred from the profane, however we understand those things? And I'm not sure that we do. I think that we look and experience life with ritualistic elements, with spiritual elements, and it is the full panoply of experience that we're looking for. Now, when I put down as a sermon title Groundhog's Day, there was some sense of, come on, even by Unitarian standards, that's got to be a little crazy. But Groundhog's Day, and I'm going to look at it from a couple of different ways, as well as in my favorite sermon, which turned out to be about Groundhog's Day, that Jim Gallagher remembers well. It's one of his favorite of my sermons. Groundhog's Day is about religion and ritual, and to some extent about nonsense, another three things that actually go together pretty well: religion, ritual, and nonsense. People look at a groundhog and say, well, the groundhog's going to predict the weather. It's going to come out, and if he sees his shadow, it means it's a sunny day, and you're going to be punished for that sunny day. There's a whole sense of karma involved in Groundhog's Day, which is, if it's sunny today, don't get too excited. There's another bunch of weeks for winter. On the other hand, if it's gloomy today, if he can't see his shadow, if it's completely overcast, then, you know, nature's going to be kind and reward you with an early spring. It is a great sense of irrational hope and the ability to try to discern patterns where the patterns may not be exactly intrinsic. One of the best examples of that is we gaze up at the stars. I see Orion's Belt, but I only see three stars if I don't know it's called Orion's Belt. We see the patterns, we make the patterns, we give them names, we try to make sense of them. Then we, of course, being human beings, we go at least one step too far and then start looking at the stars as if they were compelling our actions down here. And pretty soon, we're in astrology. And we've gone from all of those stars out there to patterns in the stars to those patterns causing behaviors down here. This is the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy that roosters cause the sunrise. You put together two phenomena and you go, well, it makes sense to me if I don't think it through too clearly. Now, if you want to make Poxitali Phil into a real science experiment, you keep track, but then a real scientist would do something else, would manipulate the results. If Phil pops up on a sunny day, what would happen if you put something there to block the sun and adumbrate it? Would it then cause a different reaction? Or if it were a cloudy day and you shone a light and he could see a shadow, well, it's the seeing his shadow. He's got to see it. Or do we have to see it? I mean, you can see how nonsensical this can get and this is. And fortunately, almost no one takes it seriously. But it's the model of a lot of superstition. A lot of the rituals that we go through, whether it's putting my shoe on the left shoe first or the right shoe first or reading the newspaper in a certain way, as Anne was talking about, ritual is important to human beings because it's one of the ways that we order the chaos. I mean, Groundhog's Day just comes around every year. It's a ritual. these guys dress up in silly costumes like a secular priesthood, and they come out there self-consciously, pompously making the announcements in a set litany, and it does what ritual does, which is give order to the world and to the experience. You may have noticed that we've done something shocking in this congregation. We moved the greeting from this pulpit to that pulpit, and there are people who are twitching because that's not the way the universe was meant to operate. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get used to the hymn being moved down about four items. Not intrinsically important, but we hang on to things, and we hang on to rituals because they create in us a sense of control, a sense of predictability. Predictability is very important to human beings. As I've pointed out from time to time, we would rather have predictably bad than take a chance on something being either great or terrible, which explains fast food franchises. We know it won't be any good, but we know exactly how it won't be any good, and we're not going to take a chance at Fred's Falafel when we've got some unnamed chain that does a completely adequate, if unexceptional, job, because there's a comfort level that we have in ritual. And I wouldn't give up Groundhog's Day. Do I believe in it? Absolutely not. Would I miss it if these clowns did not get up every year and announce that he's seen his shadow? Absolutely. It's part of how I measure a year. The various rituals and milestones, but not intrinsically important. The second part to this kind of secular holiday is, of course, today is Super Bowl Sunday. It is a deeply religious event because when you have... Come on, what are we doing here? We have music. We sing. In normal religious institutions, you have a great battle between good and evil, and two different religious institutions may disagree on which is good and which is evil. We're back to Super Bowl Sunday. You have communion. The communion is in wine in most religions. My background, it's in whining, but that's another story. And communion in Super Bowl Sunday is mostly in beer and guacamole. But it is communion. It is people coming together to do exactly what communion is, to be with each other, to celebrate, to be involved in a common experience. This is our great secular holiday because what other holiday really, across the religion lines and the class lines and the ethnic lines, brings America together in celebration? It's deeply, it usually goes out of its way to be apolitical, although one ad this year is going to transgress that line, but we'll see what that means. For the most part, however, it is about celebration. And it's about struggle. And that makes it, in a sense, a national communal experience. And what, when people refer to secular religion, that's what secular religion is. It's singing, it's dancing, it's pattern, it's order, it's struggle. It's a wonderful day. The second part of what I wanted to talk about in terms of Groundhog's Day was, and here's where the message will be in about four paragraphs, I was doing a sermon some years ago. I don't remember how many years ago it was, Jim. But I do remember I was dying. Nothing was working. I had planned the sermon. I had worked on the sermon. It really looked good on paper. And I'm looking out at people who are going like this. The polite ones were looking at their watches. The really frustrated ones were shaking them. Did this damn thing stop? And I'm thinking, well, I don't really want to say, I'm sorry, I'm stinking up the place, because the three people that thought I was saying something, I would have been dissing them. So I'm looking to find something that's going to make an eye light up, to make some kind of reaction happen, because what I do on Sunday mornings and what everybody does in the world is about relationships. It's not about, I have a sermon and I'm going to read it to you. I have the music and I'm going to play it. It's about being alive to each other. So as I noticed that it was not working, I looked for some other way to make the point and somehow landed on Groundhog's Day. Well, the first eyes that I saw light up were Jim's. And so I started playing it to Jim. So on the Groundhog's Day, I'm getting the feedback loop, almost like a Baptist church, you know. Yeah, teach, brother. And so I'm talking about what I got from the movie, and I don't do movie sermons normally. This was the accidental sermon, but the movie spoke to me because it was about a guy who was not very nice, who's trying to seduce a woman who is much too good for him, which is probably redundant. Anyway, so he's trying to pretend that he's a good guy, and as those of you who've seen the movie know, he wakes up every morning and it's the same day, the same date. Sonny and Cher are singing on the radio, "I Got You, Babe," and he could have been really upset, but he's trying to learn. And each day, which is in each incarnation, he's learned something. Now, he's still trying to learn for the wrong reason. He's trying to learn how to pretend to be decent so she'll be attracted to him. But as the incarnations go over and over and over again, he starts doing the right thing, not as a manipulation, but to do the right thing. I've never seen a more powerful Hindu movie about the perfection of the soul and about learning how to be and become for good reasons. It doesn't mean that you give up your ultimate objective, but it means that you are trying to do it as a connection as opposed to the using of another person. He comes into touch with values and learning that created values for him, and he became a valuable person. And in the end, he did get the girl for the right reason. And presumably, the clock shifted and we returned to ordinary time, and he learned something through these various incarnations. And to me, the message is clear. Life can be, when we are open to it, a learning experience. We can start out chasing after some things, what Ecclesiastes would have called vanities, and upon examination, find out what is truly valuable to us. Find out what we truly value, and to try to live according to those values. It deals with learning and with an examined life, not simply going by rote or by impulse. And here's the heart of this sermon about a sermon. I seldom hold myself up to be exemplary, but in this case I will. When something's not working, change. That's not opportunism. When somebody says, but I've given it so much work, so much planning, I've got to do it the way I planned it. No, you ask, what was the purpose of why I got up in the first place? Or why I went to work? Or why I'm in this relationship with a person? What is the purpose and how am I achieving it? And mechanics, thinking that it looked good on paper, wasn't going to do it. I remember I had it was about my fourth year in the ministry. I had an intern studying with me who was a gifted musician and probably the worst natural preacher I have ever seen in my life. Good guy, really smart. and he wrote a wonderful sermon.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it's nobler, does the mind suffer the slings? There was nothing. He had a relationship with a page. He didn't have a relationship with the people. I came up with a brilliant idea, one of the most brilliant ideas I've ever had, because he was a musician.
I had him double space his sermon, and I put in musical indications. Crescendo, glissando, fortissimo, pianissimo, piano. It was such a good idea. It didn't work at all. And so the moral of this, the core of the sermon, is whether you're dealing in a sermon or you're dealing at work or you're dealing at home, actions proceed from values. Values are only values when we actually examine them, and then we think about how it is that we can do them, be them, become them, make them incarnate in our lives. But they have to be evaluated. You can change, I can change a technique, a sermon, a plan, a strategy, but not simply haphazardly and opportunistically. It needs to be coming out of what the value intent was. Let me be specific about my relationship here with Jim in that sermon. One of the questions that interns used to ask me was, how in the world do you get up and talk about different stuff every week? Aren't you someday going to run out of sermons? No. No. Do you know that much? No. I'm not an expert on everything I talk about. I talk about things in order to find out what I think right now, but as I've indicated in other sermons, I'm sometimes wrong. I'll look at an old sermon and go, what was I thinking? Often my interns would want to, their first goal was, how can I fill 20 minutes and have them like me? Well, I want to fill 20 minutes and I want you to like me, but that's not why I get up. And you want to fill 24 hours or you want to fill 18 hours of consciousness and want people to like you, that's all fine, but that's not why you get up. The question is, how do we use these moments that we have together? How do we use these moments, whether in church or at work or at home, in however we lead our lives, and do they proceed from time filling or simply entertaining or from something that comes from a deeper place of examined values? And I submit to you that the issue for most of us in this perfectibility of life idea, that we can be better from day to day, we are not prisoners of our past, but as we examine our values, as we examine how congruent our lives are with our values, we can change strategies for achieving value with this time that we spend together. As long as we hold steady to the values that we have chosen that represent us in the world and nourish us in the world, and I believe needs to nourish the world in this feedback loop. Just last night I was asked by someone that profoundly religious question about how is it that we reach out to help others when we're not perfect ourselves. And the answer to that, I think, is very clear. If I wait to be perfect, I will teach nothing, I will achieve nothing, I will build nothing, I will love no one, because I know my considerable flaws. I become better by being better to other people. There's a feedback loop between self and world. I don't live in a vacuum. You don't live in a vacuum. When we are good to people, we open up their lives and hearts, and we open up our own hearts. Yesterday, in the mail, I received a little note card from the Peace Corps saying, it's time to remember your service and remember why you went into the Peace Corps and go out and testify in front of high schools to encourage people to be of service. It's a good example of what I'm talking about, which is the service that we did, my generation that was in the Peace Corps, and presumably other generations also. Did we benefit more, or did the host countries benefit more? I don't know. I don't know how to calculate it. I know that it was win-win. I know that by being of service to people, I learned an awful lot about myself and about the world. I know that some of the people that I lived with, that I worked with, that I, whom I taught, cannot carry simply a stereotype about what an American is, because they've had actual experience of being with Americans, good and bad, but essentially human. Giving, being open, opens others and opens ourselves, and that takes us to the ultimate intimacy of knowing our connection in this interdependent web of being that we share with each other in this beautiful day, in this holy week of excess and joy and celebration, and a day that when you walk outside and you look to the hills from whence cometh sometimes our help and sometimes a mudslide, you see the snow-capped mountains and you just go, hallelujah. Some days it's just good to be here and to be here with each other.